Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Roughly 40% of Americans will get cancer at some point in their lives. And with treatments improving, which is good news, more and more of those people will survive. But what happens after treatment? Many survivors struggle with ongoing physical issues, anxiety, depression, loneliness as they try to navigate their new normal. So being a survivor can be a challenge in its own right. So this hour on Point, we're going to take a look at support and strategies after cancer. And you can join us. Are you a cancer survivor? What has life been like after treatment? Did you have the same kind of supports or strategies that you had when you were dealing with trying to kick your disease? Have you watched a family member struggle with survivorship? What is it that folks need who may have years, decades ahead of them? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be connecting with Laura Landreau, who is a writer for The Wall Street Journal, who had recently wrote an article this week in The Wall Street Journal titled, You've Survived Cancer, What Comes Next? But joining us first today from Washington is Julia Rowland. She's former director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute. She's senior strategic advisor for the Smith Center for Health and the Arts, a cancer center in Washington, D.C. Julia Rowland, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's delightful to be here today and have the opportunity to talk about this important topic, cancer survivorship.
Yeah. So first of all, tell us, I mean, how long has even just the Center of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute existed? I'll be honest, it's not something I had heard of before this week.
It's a well-kept secret. Actually, the Office of Cancer Survivorship was established in 1996, in part by successful efforts and lobbying by the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship that's also mentioned in Laura's article. So that the office was created specifically in response to the realization that we weren't funding enough research looking at the long-term and later consequences of living with a history of cancer. And as more and more individuals can expect that to happen for them, as you've noted the statistics, it's become increasingly important for us to recognize that it's not over when treatment's over. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many survivors talk about starting a whole new beginning, life after cancer.
Right. So give us some of the challenges or details around what life after cancer looks like. First and foremost, there are many lingering physical effects from the cancer treatment that people have undergone.
Absolutely. We think about the effects of cancer treatment as falling in three categories, what we call the acute effects, so that it come very rapidly on the onset of treatment, so post-surgical pain, hair loss, anemia, nausea, vomiting, that often when treatment ends, those go away. However, as we've talked to more and more survivors, now thousands of survivors, what we're beginning to hear is that there are many side effects that occur during treatment that persist when treatment ends. Fatigue, pain syndromes, memory problems, sexual dysfunction, worry that the cancer is going to come back. And the third category of effects are called late effects that show up 6 months to years after cancer treatment. And those can include certainly second malignancies or recurrences, but also cardiac problems, lymphedema, diabetes, bone health issues, big chronic problems that we wouldn't have expected normally in this population without exposure to cancer.
Huh. And do we know why these late effects may emerge that long after treatment has ceased for cancer?
Meghna, that's a great question. And we're really, that's where the science is headed, is trying to say, who's at most risk for developing these? Because we know not everyone gets these kinds of problems. And some people get the full array of them. So the question is, who's at most risk? So we know people come into cancer with premorbid risk. So you may have a cardiac history in your family, and certainly treatment doesn't help that in most cases. It might exacerbate it. We know that some of our earlier treatments, getting less so now, were toxic themselves. So radiation is a cancer-inducing treatment. Chemotherapy affects lots of end organs. So as people are living longer, we are now seeing these late effects emerge. We hadn't worried about them in the historical past because people didn't live long enough to develop them. But as you said, the majority of people who are diagnosed today will be here at least 5 years, and many 10 and growing numbers 20 and a lifetime later.
I see. This is absolutely fascinating. So just sticking with the long-term effects that are induced by the treatment itself, ideally there would be a way to develop new cancer treatments that are effective in stopping the cancer, but also not producing the long-term damage or health effects.
Absolutely.
Is that a pipe dream?
Oh, that's not a pipe dream. That's actually happening. We actually saw it happen first in our childhood cancer survivors, where we've had the most dramatic success stories. Here I think of children diagnosed with leukemia back in the 70s. That was a death sentence for many of them. Now they'll be cured of their leukemia. But the treatment for that often includes treatment of the central nervous system, and what they used to use was a combination of radiation and chemotherapy. But what they found was the radiation, which was delivered to the brain to make sure that cells weren't hiding in the central nervous system, we found was very toxic for these children. So the pediatric oncology community, the pediatric cancer community, came back and said, can we eliminate radiation from the protocol for these children because the late effects are so consequential? And so they studied children and said, very low risk children don't need it. Those at intermediate risk, we might be able to see whether they do or don't. Those at high risk, we'll treat them, but maybe with lower doses. And they've had great success in modifying those treatment protocols, the regimens, to reduce late toxicity. We're beginning to see the same effect for adult cancers. Hodgkin's disease, again, changing the treatment in there. We now have the emergence of targeted therapies where you can go more specifically to the affected cells and save normal cell function. Mm. That's really where the science is headed, and tailoring it to the individual, which is very important.
Right. So there's a lot of possibility there. In the big picture, we also have to discuss the emerging costs of all of those kinds of very specialized therapies. But that's for another conversation at a future date. Now, what about the sort of emotional, mental, even spiritual aftermath of treatment? Because, I mean, I imagine that the intensity of being treated for cancer is so high that, you know, folks who are lucky enough to have a great support system around them, I've been seeing that and hearing that oftentimes as that support system might, you know, not drop away completely but shift, that a kind of loneliness emerges after cancer therapies.
Magna, there's no question. You're absolutely right. So first of all, cancer doesn't affect just a body. It affects psychological well-being, emotional functioning, social functioning, an existential sense of self. And what happens for many individuals, because treatments are so fast and full, they absorb full energy and attention of individuals going through them, that often dealing with some of those issues gets put off till later. So what we've heard many survivors talk about is they finish treatment and then all of a sudden they have the space to even begin to consider what's happened to them.
Uh-huh.
That, as you mentioned earlier, what is this new normal? How am I supposed to make sense of this experience and move forward? What lessons can I take from this and embrace in my life as I look to the future? We do see, you know, later, as I said, late effects of anxiety, depression, worry that the cancer will come back. There is that sense of social isolation. You're finished treatment. Everybody goes hurrah, including yourself if you're a survivor. But then the reality sets in. Wait a minute. It's really not over. I have these lingering effects. How long are those going to go on? How am I supposed to deal with them? And the very involved medical team that some may have been delivering the care kind of steps back. And so survivors talk about that transition to recovery is sometimes stunningly frightening, that all their anxiety comes back because who's going to be following them? Now the treatment stopped, will a cancer grow back? I'm feeling worse than I started on this particular journey. And my friends and family all want me to be not only fine, but the person I was before, and that's not happening. So coming to grips with that is one of the big areas of challenge for individuals who are post-treatment or living with long-term therapy for their cancers.
That sounds like an incredibly heavy burden for an individual to bear. Do you know what I mean?
Is,
like the the expectation that you, like, even from loved ones, to that you've beat this thing, you just pick up where you left off before your cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, and I caution when in my practice, when I see individuals who are making that transition, I ask them to sit back and think, when's the first time they had a symptom that something might be wrong? You need to go back to that point in time on the calendar and think, okay, and where are you now? How many weeks and months has it been since you were in treatment? Let's say that was 9 months. You need to consider that you need 9 months of recovery, that it's almost a day for a day, sort of like jet travel for an hour. Every day is an hour of jet travel to get back in your time zone. It's similar for cancer survivors, is trying to say you need a recovery period, and we don't educate individuals that that's going to be important. Family and friends need to know, too, that additional support is needed during that transition. It doesn't just snap to a stop when treatment stops. Mm. I think – so that's one side. The good news, Megan, is that there's so much more awareness about this as an issue that we have more resources available to people who are in that space. And that, to me, is very exciting, that there is greater recognition that you can't, as we used to do in the past, and the sort of slang term for it is treat them and street them, that you – it's over and done with, next, bring in the next person. No, we have an obligation to – address the challenges of being cured or living long-term with these illnesses. Right. And that's happening.
Well, we are talking this hour about life after cancer and what now, especially since by the year 2030, there's an expected number of some 22 million Americans who will be cancer survivors in 2030 and what kind of supports they need after they've beaten the cancer. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about care and support that survivors of cancer need after they've beaten their cancer, because there will be some 22 million Americans by the year 2030 who will be survivors of cancer. And there's this emerging awareness that even after the cancer treatment is over, folks need support, medical support, emotional support, even spiritual support. And so we want to hear from you. Are you a cancer survivor and you found that life after cancer wasn't as straightforward as you thought it was going to be? What happened to you and how did you get help? And did you get it from your medical team? I'm joined today by Julia Rowland. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. She's the former director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute. She's senior strategic advisor for the Smith Center for Healing and the Arts. It's a cancer center in Washington, a longtime clinician, researcher, and teacher in the psychosocial aspects of cancer. And now joining us from Seattle is Laura Landreau. She wrote an article this week in the Wall Street Journal called "You've Survived Cancer, What Comes Next?" She's former informed patient columnist and assistant managing editor at the Wall Street Journal as well. Laura Landreau, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Meghna.
I'm very glad that we had you. In total transparency, there were some technical difficulties because we wanted to start the show off with you, Laura, but I'm delighted that we were able to connect with you. So thank you for bearing with us. But first of all, I was wondering, Laura, if you might tell us your story about cancer survivorship, because you were first diagnosed with a cancer some 27 years ago when you were 37. What happened?
Yes, it was 1992, and it was a chronic myelogenous leukemia, which is a form of blood cancer. And at the time, the only possible cure was a bone marrow transplant. And I was very fortunate to have two brothers who were identical matches. You need a genetic match to have a, you know, really successful transplant. And so we ended up here in Seattle to have that transplant, and fortunately, it was successful. It was successful for about 10 years, and then the cancer started to come back. So we tried a couple of other approaches. There were some new therapies. The drug Gleevec was there. I was able to get some more cells from my brother. And that happened again in 2006 and 2007. So it was, you know, with cancer, one of the biggest things you have to worry about is recurrence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the survivorship issues that's most important. How do you have vigilance? How do you keep testing? How do you stay on top of the issues that are going to be important to you so that you know not only whether you're at risk for the cancer coming back, but whether you're at risk for other things like new cancers?
So how did you deal with that in the first years after your cancer treatment?
Well, I was very careful. You know, at first you went back you were tested every 3 months, then every 6 months, and then every year. And you just have to keep on top of the blood work. In this case, you know, can tell you pretty quickly, and the tests have evolved. So you used to have to wait 2 weeks to find out if you were okay or not. Now it's you can sometimes get the answers in the same afternoon.
Oh, wow.
But you really have to be vigilant. You know, it's you may not have a survivorship clinic or something near you. You may have moved away from your doctors. I lived in New York and went to Seattle for care. So you have to sometimes really be your own advocate. Well, you have to always be your own advocate, and you have to be very careful to just do the follow-up, do the screening, do the tests. And I'm not talking about over-testing. I'm not talking about being paranoid all the time and thinking about nothing else, but you do have to follow up.
Huh. Julia Rowland, would you like to reflect on what Laura's saying about patients needing to be their own advocates for a lot of these issues?
Thanks for joining us. I'm sorry for your technical difficulties, Mike. I had traffic difficulties. But I want to thank you first for writing this piece and being very open about your own experience, because I think the more that we can talk about these issues, the better we are able to address it. And it kind of brings it, quote, like out of the closet. And I think that one of the reasons we have such a strong focus on cancer survivorship today is because survivors have stood up and been willing to tell their story. Perhaps, you know, the most recognized one today is Cokie Roberts, who died subsequent to her mm-hmm. treatment for cancer.
Mm-hmm. But right. When Remember you talk First You Cry, the book way back. Yeah.
Yes. Betty Rollins, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. So prominent figures talking about their illness have been very important. And you're absolutely right. Vigilant post-cancer is important. And the focus historically has been on cancer recurrence and then maybe a second cancer, although, again, historically, most people didn't live long enough to get the second cancer. They're more worried about a recurrence. But that's not enough. I mean, we also talked just before you joined us, Laura, about taking care of the rest of the person, whether that's emotional well-being, social functioning, and your other physical health, because we know also these treatments put you at risk for other comorbid or competing conditions, whether that's issues with your heart or your lungs or your liver because of your exposure. Bone marrow transplant, great example of that. You might have lingering effects due to that. So knowing what to do about that is important. And we now have the opportunity really to focus on that because we can expect people to live long enough to need to be dealing with these issues.
Mm. Well, Julia and Laura, just hang on here for a second because we have a lot of callers who have experiences and stories they want to share with us. So let's go to Anne, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So it's really interesting you have this topic. I was diagnosed with third stage Hodgkin's disease in the 80s. And prior to that time, most people died of third stage, but they were having this experimental chemotherapy called MOP. And it was very toxic. It was very I mean, I was vomiting all the time. I was weak all the time. I was on and off of it for a year because my body couldn't take it, and then I would have to go to radiation. But anyway, the bottom line is I was, you know, 20 then, and I'm 60 now, and I have started to discover over the last maybe 10 years that the chemo and the radiation, where I had them, is still affecting my body. Uh-huh. My thyroid was... I've had lots of problems with my thyroid, so lots of problems with fatigue and dental issues that were related to the radiation. I was cured from from the cancer, though, so but they took that combination out shortly after I got off of it because it they realized it was so toxic, and people were choosing not to take it. They would rather just die than that. And in the 80s, you were let go. You were like, okay, you're treated. Goodbye. They didn't.
Right.
Support groups were not really available back then. And you didn't ask questions of your doctors then. You just said, okay, yes, sir.
Right.
So
well,
it's been a long discovery of even my emotions of being out of control. And it's so interesting that you're talking about, you know, really long term. I mean,
It's so evolving. 9 months afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you for your call. Laura, I hear you wanted to respond to Anne there.
Well, I'm just, you know, she's so right. You know, the fact is cancer treatments in the 80s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s were very toxic. They were just blasting people with radiation and chemo. And I think there weren't as many. They were just focusing on let's have a cure here, let's treat them, and not thinking about the longer term effects. And I think the good news for today's cancer patients is they are doing a lot of things. There's a lot of trials and a lot of new approaches to make that the actual treatment less toxic in the first place. So very targeted radiation or no radiation in some cases for Hodgkin's, non-Hodgkin's patients. So, you know, it is evolving, but for those people who, you know, were treated when it wasn't evolved, yes, you especially have to think about those, what they call late-term effects.
I see. Julia Rowland, and Laura wrote about this in her piece, are treatment centers and hospitals moving to sort of a new paradigm where they towards the end of a patient's treatment, they begin to talk about sort of what... a survivorship plan, per se. I'm not quite sure what else to call it. I mean, is that increasingly becoming part, or is it already part of cancer treatments today?
Let me come back in one second to survivorship care plans, but I wanted to say thank you, Anne, so much for calling in. And, you know, again, congratulations for your long-term survivorship. Your story is not unique. This is what we hear time and again from individuals with Hodgkin's disease, but many other kinds of cancers who talk about their treatment in an earlier era and the lack of awareness of what the consequences of that would be. I had one wonderful colleague and long-term survivor who talked about her cure as being the gift that keeps on giving as she developed one more complication after another and even second malignancies as a function of her curative therapy. So thank you for raising awareness about that. And yes, to your Meghna, from your question, no question that big treatment centers who see a large volume of individuals for cancer, treat a large volume of individuals for cancer, very aware of this. Many of them now, the big centers have survivorship programs or clinics or special services for that population specifically. And there have been a number of reports, national level reports, out of the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academies of Science, that have highlighted what we need to be attending to in survivor's care. There's one report in particular that came out on adult cancer survivorship called Cancer Lost in Transition. Right. It came out in 2006, and it enumerates the long-term and late effects. But importantly, it highlighted that they recommended every individual is treated for cancer get a survivorship care plan. There are two components to that. One is a treatment summary that would talk about all of the nature of your cancer, the tumor markers, the staging, all treatments delivered, if you add radiation to what areas it was delivered, chemotherapy, what type, in some cases, what doses, any complications you may have had. And that information is then taken to develop a follow-up care plan. So it's very tailored because it's going to be based on who you are, how old you are. If you're 20, it's very different than if you're 55, than if you're 80. And what kind of health conditions were there already, what kind of cancer you had, but most importantly, what treatments you had. And then there's a plan for action. And that concept, survivorship care plan, is beginning to take off across the country.
I see. Now, Laura, in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, you wrote about how, anything that takes a medical team's time, it costs money, and that there's a bill that was introduced in the House that would allow doctors to bill Medicare for time they spent creating these plans?
For the time spent creating these plans, yes, because again, with doctors, everything, as you know, the demands on their time are so high. But I think what's interesting about the survivorship care plan is the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer, which originally made that a requirement of accreditation, is now looking at that again and saying, you know, a survivorship care plan is not enough at one of these big centers or one of the treatment centers. You need to show us what you're doing. You can't just give these people a couple of pieces of paper and say, here's your plan. We need to know what you're doing to make sure that the services they need are delivered, whether they be just simple testing or, you know, emotional and psychological, psychosocial. What are you doing to either link them to resources, refer them to specialists, put them into folks in the community that might be able to help them? So I think what they want to do is go beyond just a piece of paper and a plan and really try to make sure that cancer treatment centers are doing, you know, the real, they're putting their money where their mouth is, and, you know, we're really going to care for you going forward. And I think that's where these survivorship clinics come in.
And Julie, if you could just hang in here for a second, there's so many callers. I just want to be able to be sure to give them their dues. So let's go to Jill, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. And thank you, Julia and Laura, for all that you're sharing about this. I am a 7-year breast cancer survivor, and I agree with everything that I've been hearing here about being your own advocate, but also not being necessarily aware of some of the ramifications and the ongoing. I loved what the phrase that one of your guests used about the gift that keeps on giving. Mm-hmm. Because while I'm very grateful that I've survived and I learned a lot through that process, there's a lot of things that happen when you're first diagnosed that you are thrown so much information and you have to make a lot of really quick decisions that are life-changing and life-altering. And so you do tend to obviously trust your medical team. I had a wonderful medical team. I'm cancer-free at this point. But the ramifications and long-term consequences of radiation, of the breast implants that I was convinced that I should get, I'm having problems with that now. And they aren't detrimental to my health, but they definitely affect the quality of life. I'm also, I guess my question would be, what Julia and Laura have seen from the medical community, because my experience is that when I had cancer, the medical community, every one of my doctors was so all in. Every little tweak or blip that I had, they were concerned about, they looked into it. But now when I come to them about different things or questions about things such as the recent news coverage about the implants that have been recalled, there's nothing. There's an uncomfortableness, and there's also almost a dismissiveness about my concerns because it's not really fixable in their mind. And I just like to kind of get their input from that, and I'll take my call off the air.
Jill,
thank you so much.
Yeah, Jill, thank you for your call. Laura, do you have a response for Jill?
Well, I think, you know, it is correct that many of the oncology providers are really focused on treatment, and then the primary care docs, or whoever you're handing yourself off to, might not have the kind of full knowledge of what these after effects or these later concerns might be. I think one of the good things that's out there is many of these, you know, cancer survivor groups, these wellness communities and cancer support communities, a lot of local grassroots resources that help patients through some of this stuff. There's a really good network out there, I think, of many of these organizations who can not only provide things like, you know, yoga classes that work with if you've had lymphedema or something, but there's actually help with the resources to get you through some of these, particularly in breast cancer. So many organizations, and I think finding, you know, one of those organizations might be helpful.
Mm. And Julia, I mean, Jill said that she was shocked or dismayed by the lack of education, for example, on the part of doctors that she's seeing after her cancer treatment. I mean, it sounds like that is not uncommon.
I think that continues to be a challenge, even though more and more cancer clinicians are aware that survivorship is an important topic to address. Many don't feel equipped to talk about it. Even though this is their bread and butter, they're treating patients and should be aware of the long-term and late effects, which is why the clinics have arisen around the country. I think Laura brings up an excellent point, too, though. We do have extraordinary grassroots efforts. I think of the entity that I work with right now, Smith Center for Healing in the Arts, which was developed at the same time as the Office of Cancer Survivorship, 1996, provides all those integrative care services to patients in the greater Washington, D.C. area. So yoga, nutrition, creativity, stress management, relaxation, education about what happens after cancer. We have a patient navigation program to help put together those kinds of services and programs for individuals. And we have cancer retreats that actually cover the whole array, allow people to step back, experience all of these healing modalities in a safe and beautiful environment, to put the pieces together for themselves. And I think being aware of what's in the program and organization in your backyard is very important. Mm.
Well, Julia Rowland and Laura Landro join us this hour because we're talking about what happens after cancer. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what happens after cancer and the kind of medical, emotional, spiritual supports that people need for long-term survivors of cancer. And we're joined today by Laura Landro. She's with us from Seattle, Washington. She wrote this week in the Wall Street Journal an article headlined, "You've Survived Cancer, What Comes Next?" Laura's currently a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. She's former informed patient columnist and assistant managing editor there as well. Julia Rowland joins us from Washington. She's former director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute and a senior strategic advisor for the Smith Center for Healing and the Arts, which is a cancer center in Washington, D.C. And let's turn now to Phoenix, Arizona, where Sudella Maddalena joins us. She's chief administrative officer at the Cancer Support Community in Phoenix. She was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer 20 years ago at the age of 31. Her cancer recurred a couple of years after her initial treatment. Sudella Maddalena, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for including me in this conversation.
It's great to have you. So tell us a little bit about what the cancer support community does in Phoenix.
Sure. We are part of a national organization called the Cancer Support Community. We have more than 40 affiliates around the country. And basically, we provide free psychosocial support for cancer patients, their family members, caregivers, anyone who's been touched by cancer. Our programs are designed to provide folks with a menu of resources that they can access so they can put together a personalized plan that will give them the tools and resources that they need to deal with cancer survivorship. Mm. We see people who are currently in treatment as well as people who are out of treatment and in remission and, you know, experiencing very high levels of anxiety waiting for potentially that other shoe to drop, which is recurrence.
I see. And how do people find you? Are they referred to you by their medical teams?
Generally, yes. Okay. We also try to do a fair amount of publicity in the community to let people know that we're here. But we do have strong relationships with health practitioners and hospitals, and we actually have hospital navigators in a few of the hospitals that work directly with the cancer patients there.
I see. And what difference has or have these resources made to people who come to the cancer support community?
Well, you know, I'll speak from my own personal experience first, and then I will tell you that generally people who come to us really have a transformative experience. When I was diagnosed at the age of 31, I didn't know anyone with cancer. I was terrified. My life felt like it was over at that time, and I was given a very poor prognosis. I had a very aggressive tumor. It had already micrometastasized, and you know, I was told that I probably had about a 10% chance of survival. So for me, that was terrifying. Yeah. And I was able to go to the cancer support community in Santa Monica. And for me, it was transformative because I was able to be around other people who were experiencing what I was. So I could be completely honest about what was going on with me. A lot of times you find yourself filtering how you're feeling and what you're experiencing to the people who are in your life because you don't want to make them feel any worse than they already feel or any more helpless to do anything for you. And so I, over a course of 5 years, I actually was in remission for 2 years and then had a recurrence in my spine in three places and had a stem cell transplant. I was involved in the cancer support community, and I was able to develop a set of tools that help me move on into my life, put my life back together, and actually I continue to practice some of those today in my everyday life. So we see that with the people that come to us. Generally, we see people coming to us within about 3 to 6 months after treatment because, as has been mentioned earlier in the conversation today, when you're going through treatment, you feel like you're doing something and something is being done to keep that cancer at bay. It's when the treatments are over that you start to focus on things like recurrence. You're dealing with all of the aftermaths of, you know, the damage to relationships, the expectations of people that you're just going to get back to life as normal, and you don't feel that way. And so what we're able to offer people at no cost to them is a place to come where they can be part of a community. They can select the resources and tools that are going to help them in their journey. And, you know, we hear every day how important and how transformative this program has been for them.
Well, Sudella Maddalena with us from Phoenix, Arizona, Chief Administrative Officer at the Cancer Support Community in Phoenix. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Laura and Julia, let me just ask you a question. So Sudella's working at a place in Phoenix, talking to you, Laura, in Seattle, and Julia in Washington, and here I am sitting in Boston. So some very urban centers here, where folks might have a lot of options. Are we seeing an expansion of these kinds of either support centers, groups, or approaches, you know, outside of America's bigger cities, Laura?
Well, when I was reporting this story, yes, I was interested to find the National Coalition on Cancer Survivorship has a very interesting program they're just launching now called Elevate Survivorship, I think, and they are trying to find people. That is a very good issue. You know, what do we do with the people that aren't next to, you know, Memorial Sloan Kettering or the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center? How do we reach out to more rural areas? And I know that they are picking individuals who've been cancer survivors and really training them to be ambassadors to their local communities. You know, and one of the women that they mentioned to me was in, you know, somewhere in rural South Dakota. So yes, I think there are more of these. And, of course, you do, thanks to, you know, the web, you have the ability to do a lot of this online. You know, the original chat rooms that were there, when I first started looking into this years ago, you know, they had what they used to call the Association of Cancer Online Resources. They were really email discussion lists. Mm-hmm. And now you can do a lot more with that and with different groups that provide that support through online apps and things like that.
Julia, I mean, do you think, what's your response to that same question? Are we getting these supports enough to more rural communities? Because obviously cancer doesn't have any, it doesn't discriminate between, you know, who it strikes.
Right. No boundaries here. And it's an equal opportunity effector, if you like. And I would agree with Laura that we've really come a long way. It's not just these online email listservs in here, but we have actually telephone counseling programs. Cancer Care in New York, based in New York City, does a wonderful teleconference series regularly on various topics related to cancer that's incredibly informative, great educator in that regard. They also do phone counseling. I think there is more on the internet, and there are peer-to-peer counseling programs and matching programs. I'm so glad that Laura mentioned the effort, the Elevate effort at the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship. In full disclosure, I sit on their board. I think that's a great new opportunity to get the word out there, because I don't think just expecting treatment centers to be responsible for this is sufficient. And most people, you know, may not live near, as you mentioned, Meghna, a big center, but rather commute in, and we want to be sure we're getting out to the remote parts of, you know, Arkansas or Montana or Appalachia. The people who are living in those areas and touched by cancer are not alone.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if this is what we're seeing here is also the emergence of a whole new area of healthcare and of treatment overall. And to that, let's actually just go to Kristen, who's calling from Glasgow, Kentucky. Kristen, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about the survivorship programs. I have a daughter who 10 years ago was in Colorado University, the physiatry residency program. She was diagnosed with a synovial cell sarcoma in her left leg. After a year taking off of her physiatry residency and following the conclusion of her residency in physiatry, she decided there was a new evolving field called cancer rehab medicine. And so she did a fellowship and an MD Anderson in cancer rehab medicine. So this is a big component in a new evolving field in cancer survivorship programs. They take care of disastrous radiation, surgical cancer issues that they deal with then, rehabbing this individual or helping participate with rehab therapies to improve the lifestyle of the person or just the general feel. And anytime exercise, we know exercise is important to our life. This helps with that as well. Yeah. And she right now is practicing. She's one of a few right now, but it is an evolving field and it is an important part of the survivorship for any cancer patient.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for your call. Laura Landro, cancer rehab physicians, I mean, are we seeing the emergence of new specialties here?
Well, there is a thought. She's right. I think she's a great advocate for her daughter, too. You know, great PR campaign for mom. That's great. But we do see way more of that sort of thing because so much of it is physical rehab. It's, you know, being able to overcome your fear that, oh, if I move, I'll hurt myself, or, you know, that you need to exercise, that you need nutrition, that you need diet, that a lot of those areas, certainly with, I know in the Prostate Cancer Foundation, for example, a lot of research is being done into things like lifestyle. At University of California, San Francisco, they have all kinds of trials that they're doing with people who are cancer survivors, whether it's text messaging, reminder, you know, think about that, you know, bacon you're eating if you're worried about your recurrence for colon cancer. So I think there is a lot of research going on in this field. And I think there's a lot of opportunity, by the way. Another thing for patients, there's a lot of research, a lot of clinical trials you can participate in that are about cancer survivorship, that are about life after cancer. And you can, you know, sort of be part of the solution. So I think that is one way to look at it. There is definitely an evolution in this field.
Let's get more calls here. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. I am calling just based on my own personal experience. My mother started with breast cancer and died of bone cancer, and I was a nurse assistant to her. And then later in life, after 35 years of marriage, my wife developed pancreatic cancer, and so I was of the right mindset to care for her before she died. I can say that attitude is everything. I had pancreatic cancer, and I'm 3 years clean. I learned that having the right attitude helped me through the entire process, that I started giving thanks for everything that I saw that I was thankful for. I included my relationships, my friends, my family, my customers in my adventure. I call it an adventure because sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. And for the most part, I have developed the attitude after 3 years of being clean that the most valuable currency we have between one another as humans is the connections we make and the time we spend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have just really focused on taking advantage of the moment and being in the present and giving thanks, and that has been an incredible help for me, but everybody has been very supportive.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. Julia, I think I really enjoyed hearing what Steve had to say. Even like you could hear even in the language that he uses, his approach to talking about his cancer and how cancer has touched his life. But how can we do better in terms of giving folks the emotional support they need to foster and strengthen those very connections that Steve was talking about after treatment?
Steve, you're so right that quality of life is really important for quantity of life, and that's true whether we have cancer or not. And so having a positive attitude about what you can do to facilitate that is very important. I'd love to say positive attitude alone is curative. It is not. You can have the best attitude in the world and still not survive your cancer. So I am mindful of that.
Yeah.
But certainly for the experience, finding ways that, you know, bring you joy, help you see gratitude as part of this journey when it's a very stressful journey are real tools. Certainly, Smith Center for Healing and the Arts does that in the D.C. area. You know, Cancer Support Community does this. Other programs around the country, American Cancer Society offers programs in this vein. So finding what works is important. And social support is key here also. So you have a cancer treating team, you need a support team to go with that. I'd also like to circle back to, Kristen, your comment. Thank you for bringing up the topic of cancer rehabilitation. We're seeing greater awareness to this because many of our treatments leave individuals deconditioned after their therapy. And so finding a way back to some good level of physical function before they can leap off and do other things is important. And we're beginning to recognize that we need to address that. And even go further and say to look at the data for cancer prehabilitation. Can we help people be more fit as they enter treatment right after diagnosis, you know, begin them on programs and not wait till post-treatment, but help them approach these in a better way. And that's a very exciting new area of research. And finally, Laura's comment, are we seeing more practitioners in this? One area of enormous growth is we're seeing a specialty grow called cardio-oncology or oncocardiology, where people are taking a hard look at the relationship between cancer and its treatment and heart health.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. I'm sure we're going to see more about it.
Laura Landro, we've got about a minute and a half left here, and I'm looking at my notes and remembering that you were first diagnosed with your cancer 27 years ago. And you're speaking to us today from Seattle because every year you still travel back to Seattle for follow-up cancer testing. And with that in mind, you know, Steve was talking about connections and how that has helped him in his survivorship of pancreatic cancer. I'm just wondering how are having those connections, that emotional support, still important to you in your life these 27 years later?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have my family, but, you know, one of the things when I was talking to a lot of cancer survivors is they talk about what it taught them about life and, you know, what's important and what isn't, and many of the good things that happened to them after they had cancer. And certainly I would say some of the best things in my life happened to me. I met the love of my life after I had cancer. So, you know, you find a way to sort of jettison the things in your life that aren't, as you say, bringing you joy, somewhat overused phrase, but you jettison those things and you focus on the support and the people who are there for you and the people that are going to be, you know, always have your back. And I think that's very important for cancer survivors to build that community. If you don't already have it, maybe you can build it with other cancer survivors because certainly, you know, you're all in the same boat and you can help each other more than anyone.
Well, Laura Landro, her article in the Wall Street Journal this week is headlined, "You've Survived Cancer, What Comes Next?" We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Laura, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Julia Rowland, former director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute and senior strategic advisor for the Smith Center for Healing and the Arts in Washington. Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.